threatened from human beings are determined by Baruch Spinoza. About the author. Baruch Spinoza was born in Amsterdam to parents who had fled from the Spanish Inquisition and sought refuge in the Netherlands. His study of Descartes and Hobbes led his philosophical views away from Orthodox Jewish philosophy. Subsequently, he was excommunicated from the Jewish community. In the years thereafter, he skillfully crafted optical lenses for a living while dedicating his life to render clearly his philosophy by the geometrical method of proof. Unfortunately, his strict deductive writing style, although perhaps the clearest method of logical exposition at the time, remains to us somewhat stiff and formal. When Spinoza was offered a teaching position at Heidelberg, he wrote, "I do not know how to teach philosophy without becoming a disturber of the peace." Spinoza is best read only one sentence at a time, otherwise, the depth of this thought can easily be overlooked. Somewhat dismissively, Novalis once characterized Spinoza as a God-intoxicated man. About the work. Sometime after his sentence of excommunication, Spinoza began working of ideas which would eventually be published as the Ethics (1) a book, published posthumously from the fear of persecution, from the charge of the blasphemy of pantheism. Pantheism should be distinguished from panentheism, which is the view that gods are in all things. Spinoza believed, much as Socrates believed, the excellent life is the life of reason and the service of one's own being. The soul seeks knowledge as a good, indeed, the soul's highest good is knowledge of God. Spinoza argues that the mind and the body are, in reality, only one thing but can be thought of in two different ways. The person who understands how the soul is part of the system of nature also understands, at the same time, how the soul is part of God. Spinoza's monism (3) is the deductive exposition of existence as the complete unity of God and nature. According to this view, human beings have no free will, and the world cannot be evil. The reading selection from the Ethics. The known causes of human action. I can scarcely believe, until the fact is proved by experience, that men can be induced to consider the question calmly and fairly, so firmly are they convinced that it is merely at the bidding of the mind that the body is set in motion, or at rest, or performs a variety of actions, depending solely on the mind's will, or the exercise of thought. However, no one has hitherto laid down the limits to the powers of the body, that is, no one has as yet been taught by experience what the body can accomplish solely by the laws of nature, and so far as she is regarded as extension. No one hitherto has gained such an accurate knowledge of the bodily mechanism that he can explain all its functions, nor need I call attention to the fact that many actions are observed in the lower animals which far transcend human sagacity, and that somnambulists do many things in their sleep which they would not venture to do when awake. These instances are enough to show that the body can by the sole laws of its nature do many things which the mind wonders at. Meaninglessness of the mind's control of body. Again, no one knows how or by what means the mind moves the body, nor how many various degrees of motion it can impart to the body, nor how quickly it can move it. Thus, when men say that this or that physical action has its origin in the mind, which latter has dominion over the body, they are using words without meaning, or are confessing in specious phraseology that they are ignorant of the cause of the said action, and do not wonder at it. Similar states of mind and body. But they will say, whether we know or do not know the means whereby the mind acts on the body, we have, at any rate, experience of the fact that unless the human mind is in a fit state to think, the body remains inert. Moreover, we have experience that the mind alone can determine whether we speak or are silent, and a variety of similar states, which accordingly, we say depend on the mind's decree. But as to the first point, I ask such objectors, whether experience does not also teach that if the body be an act of the mind, is simultaneously unfitted for thinking? For when the body is at rest in sleep, the mind simultaneously is in a state of torpor also, and has no power of thinking, such as it possesses when the body is awake. Again, I think everyone's experience will confirm the statement that the mind is not at all times equally fit for thinking on a given subject, but according as the body is more or less fitted for being stimulated by the image of this or that object, so also is the mind more or less fitted for contemplating the said object. Infinite complexity of nature. But it will be urged, it is impossible, that solely from the laws of nature, considered as extended substance, we should be able to deduce the causes of buildings, pictures, and things of that kind, which are produced only by human art, nor would the human body, unless it were determined, and led by the mind, be capable of building a single temple. However, I have just pointed out that the objectors cannot fix the limits of the body's power, or say what can be concluded from a consideration of its soul nature, whereas they have experience of many things being accomplished solely by the laws of nature, which they would never have believed possible, except under the direction of mind. Such are the actions performed by somnambulists while asleep, and wondered at by their performers when awake. I would further call attention to the mechanism of the human body, which far surpasses in complexity all that has been put together by human art, not to repeat what I have already shown, namely that from nature, under whatever attribute she be considered, infinite results follow. The illusory nature of free decisions. As for the second objection, I submit that the world would be much happier if men were as fully able to keep silence as they are to speak. Experience abundantly shows that men can govern anything more easily than their tongues, and restrain anything more easily than their appetites, when it comes about that many believe that we are only free in respect to objects which we moderately desire, because our desire for such can easily be controlled by the thought of something else frequently remembered, but that we are by no means free in respect to what we seek with violent emotion, for our desire cannot then be allayed with the remembrance of anything else. However, unless such persons had proved by experience that we do many things which we afterwards repent of, and again that we often, when assailed by contrary emotions, see the better and follow the worse, there would be nothing to prevent their believing that we are free in all things. Thus an infant believes that of its own free will it desires milk, an angry child believes that it freely desires to run away further, a drunken man believes that he utters from the free decision of his mind words which when he is sober he would willingly have withheld. Thus too, a delirious man, a garrulous woman, a child, and others of like complexion believe that they speak from the free decision of their mind, when they are in reality unable to restrain their impulse to talk. Decision defined. Experience teaches us no less clearly than reason that men believe themselves to be free simply because they are conscious of their actions and unconscious of the causes whereby those actions are determined, and further it is plain that the dictates of the mind are but another name for the appetites, and therefore vary according to the varying state of the body. Everyone shapes his actions according to his emotion. Those who are assailed by conflicting emotions know not what they wish. Those who are not attacked by any emotion are readily swayed this way or that. All these considerations clearly show that a mental decision and a bodily appetite or determined state are simultaneous, or rather one and the same thing, which we call decision when it is regarded under and explained through the attribute of thought, and a conditioned state when it is regarded under the attribute of extension and deduced from the laws of motion and rest. Nature of human action. For the present, I wish to call attention to another point, namely that we cannot act by the decision of the mind unless we have a remembrance of having done so. For instance, we cannot say a word without remembering that we have done so. Again, it is not within the free power of the mind to remember or forget a thing at will. Therefore, the freedom of the mind must in any case be limited to the power of uttering or not uttering something which it remembers. But when we that we speak, we believe that we speak from a free decision of the mind, yet we do not speak, or if we do, it is by a spontaneous motion of the body. Again, we dream that we are concealing something, and we seem to act from the same decision of the mind as that whereby we keep silence when awake concerning something we know. Lastly, we dream that from the free decision of our mind we do something which we should not dare to do when awake. The idea of free will. Now I should like to know whether there be in the mind two sorts of decisions, one sort elusive, and the other sort free. If our folly does not carry us so far as this, we must necessarily admit that the decision of the mind, which is believed to be free, is not distinguishable from the imagination or memory, and is nothing more than the affirmation which an idea, by virtue of being an idea, necessarily involves. Wherefore these decisions of the mind arise in the mind by the same necessity as the ideas of things actually existing. Therefore those who believe that they speak or keep silence, or act in any way, from the free decision of their mind, do but dream with their eyes open. Thus completes the reading of human beings, are determined, by Baruch Spinoza, and are the new free documentation license. This file in this and other formats, is available on the internet at philosophy.lander.edu.